From NPR and WBUR, I'm Mina Kim.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And Republican lawmakers are pushing back today on comments made by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein yesterday. In a wide-ranging interview with a museum in Washington, the Justice Department's second-in-command was asked about reports that allies of President Trump had drafted impeachment articles against him for what they said was a failure to turn over DOJ documents on several controversial issues. Here's Rosenstein.
The Department of Justice is not going to be extorted. We're going to do what's required by the rule of law, and any kind of threats that anybody makes are not going to affect the way we do our job. We have a responsibility, and we take an oath. That's the whole point.
Well, the leader of the conservative House Freedom Caucus, Congressman Mark Meadows of North Carolina, responded on Twitter, saying if he believes being asked to do his job is extortion, then Rod Rosenstein should step aside and allow us to find a new deputy attorney general. And earlier today, President Trump tweeted, "They don't want to turn over documents to Congress. What are they afraid of?" Meantime, the Washington Post reported yesterday on a meeting in March in which special counsel Robert Mueller raised the possibility of a subpoena for the president to answer questions about possible ties between the Trump campaign and Russian interference in the 2016 presidential campaigns, as well as obstruction of justice. NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing is here. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Robin.
So first of all, Rod Rosenstein saying, you know, he will not be extorted. These articles of impeachment, which were leaked, what do they say? Who drew them up?
We don't know exactly where they come from in the House, but there has been a months-long campaign by the president's allies on the House Judiciary Committee, the House Intelligence Committee, to try and sandblast the Justice Department and the FBI for what Republicans say is the real Russia scandal. They argue that people inside Justice and the FBI have abused their powers to launch surveillance against at least one person in the president's campaign in 2016. And frame the president in this construction for the alleged collusion that might have taken place between his campaign operation and the Russian attack on the election that year. And to that end, people in the House, the Judiciary Committee Chairman Bob Goodlatte, the Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes of California, they've been asking the Justice Department for information about what was taking place at that time. And so the complaints that you just talked about by Congressman Meadows against Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein are a part of that. They want papers, information, reports, and most recently what they want is an unredacted copy of the order Rosenstein signed appointing Robert Mueller, the special counsel, which would include the full scope of his investigation. Now, that's very secret because it involves intelligence matters in Russia and so forth, but that's why they want it, and that's why they're complaining, and the president, as you mentioned, also is complaining about his refusal to give it to them.
Well, it's such a partisan issue, but what are observers saying? Is Rosenstein withholding documents from Congress?
Well, the Justice Department says it's been playing along this entire time. It has given members of Congress text messages that have really embarrassed the Justice Department and the FBI between two investigators in 2016 who criticized Trump and criticized other political figures and have given ammunition to this narrative that there were people inside the FBI, in this case, who were biased against him. But they want more. They believe there's more there that they could use to expose what they call this bias or this abuse of power by the Justice Department. And because Rosenstein isn't going along in the way that they feel he should, that's why he alluded to this extortion in that clip you played.
Look, the conservative House Freedom Caucus, very powerful in the House, but they would need two-thirds majority in the Senate. So the thinking is impeachment isn't likely. But then we have President Trump tweeting today about the president's unfettered power to fire anyone. Is the thinking he might fire Rosenstein?
Well, I think the reference the president was making in that tweet was to these allegations that the special counsel's office might be investigating whether the president obstructed justice and broke the law in responding to the investigation the FBI was doing. And what the president's supporters argue is that under his Article II powers, he can hire and fire constitutional offices in the United States government however he wishes. And as former FBI Director James Comey himself has said, the president has the power to fire an FBI director anytime he wants. And so the thinking here is if you're going to say that firing Comey was evidence of obstruction, no, the president is arguing he has that power. He can exercise it whenever he wants. And so in this case, he didn't break the law. In terms of Rosenstein, as you say, there's probably not sufficient support for him to actually be removed. But this is part of a comprehensive campaign of pressure by the president's allies in the House and the president himself to bring the Justice Department to heel, and as Rosenstein himself said, to try to intimidate them as they conduct these important investigations.
Just quickly, the White House lawyer, then lead lawyer John Dowd, is confirming with the AP that Mueller spoke with the lawyers for the president and said that he would issue a subpoena to get the president to answer questions. We have had some of those questions leaked out, questions that were drafted by a White House lawyer, Jay Sokolow, after conversations with Mueller's team. We have Trump, you know, furious about the leak, which seemed to have come from his side of the equation. But where does this stand now, the idea of the president being questioned, now that we know that Mueller would issue a subpoena if he had to?
Well, what we're seeing in the press this week is a war between these two camps among the president's advisors. There's the no interview side that says it's too dangerous for the president to agree to sit down with the special counsel or his investigators. And then there's are those who are saying if he doesn't, there'll be a subpoena, which could mean the president might be compelled to appear before a grand jury, probably at the end of a long appeals process. But it's a classic dilemma. There are two outcomes here that are probably both very unpalatable for the president. And that's why these leaks and counterleaks are taking place in Washington.
Battle in the press. NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing, thanks.
Thank you.
In North Carolina, several counties are looking to increase the number of police officers patrolling school hallways. This follows the February school shooting in Parkland, Florida. But some students of color say this would make them feel less safe. Lisa Phillip of WUNC reports.
This August, students at four elementary schools in rural Stanley County, North Carolina, will return from summer vacation to fresh pencils, notebooks, and signs announcing the presence of armed officers on campus. They are meant to protect students. Jayla Higgins doesn't see it that way.
If I had a child that was in elementary school, I wouldn't feel comfortable with a retired police officer there with a gun to, like, try and protect my children.
Higgins is a senior at Leesville High School in Raleigh. She is Black and helped organize a walkout at her school after the Parkland shooting.
It just doesn't seem very logical to me, so it's, like, hard for me to, like, even try and, like, fathom, like, what people are, like, thinking and, like, what can be at the root of that.
The Stanley County School Board made the decision soon after the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. They wanted to take advantage of a state law allowing retired law enforcement to volunteer as school resource officers. Here's Stanley County Superintendent Jeff James.
The best of all worlds, of course, is to have school resource officers, in our opinion, in every school. It's unfortunate that our society has come to that, but that's where we find ourselves these days.
School resource officers may provide a sense of security to some. To others, they represent a big shift in the way students are disciplined. Here's Jayla Higgins again.
Back in the day, right, when two students would get in a fight, they would not be put in handcuffs. They wouldn't have charges. You know, the teachers there, the administration would separate them and take them to the principal's office and they would talk through it.
But Higgins fears that once resource officers are in the schools,
if something like that happens, they're immediately, especially if they're Black and brown, they're tackled and harassed. It's completely unnecessary. They're put in handcuffs. Most likely they get charges and are suspended.
And there's data to back up Higgins' concerns. Jason Nance is a law professor at the University of Florida. He spent a lot of time analyzing federal school discipline data. He found that schools with resource officers are twice as likely to call in police when students commit minor offenses, like fighting without a weapon.
And I find that to be very problematic and sort of a problem that we have to address nationally, which is the trend to criminalize fairly common disciplinary events and involving law enforcement in those types of incidents.
Peggy Nicholson witnessed that type of behavior as an attorney for Legal Aid of North Carolina. She's now co-director of the Youth Justice Project in Durham.
I had a 8-year-old client who was referred to juvenile court for shaking his pencil at a teacher, and it was charged as communicating threats. And of course, the judge threw it out. But this 8-year-old, who was already behind academically, had to miss multiple days of school to go to court to get an attorney and to get the eventually dismissed by the judge.
Nicholson's client was a student of color. Like a large percentage of students referred to law enforcement by schools. In North Carolina, Black students make up about a quarter of enrollment, but more than half of school-based juvenile delinquency complaints.
And as a Black woman, right, with Black children, I totally reject this idea or this notion that somehow Black kids are worse. That's a lie.
Letha Muhammad is director of the Education Justice Alliance based in Raleigh.
It's the ways in which Black students are patrolled, are disciplined. That's where the problem is.
Muhammad says she wants her kids to be safe at school, but she believes that could be accomplished by providing more support staff for students. Stanley County Superintendent Jeff James agrees. His district has more than 8,000 students and two school psychologists. But James says licensed counselors are double the cost of school resource officers.
It's putting resource officers in school now. It's just hopefully a deterrent from some maniac that if they would have got proper medical and mental health treatment, then that would be the best of both worlds. Then we wouldn't have them shooting up the place to start with.
Many North Carolina schools share one psychologist, and 12 school districts operate without any. And with education funding from the state still lagging behind pre-recession levels, it's not clear when this shortage might be addressed. For Here and Now, I'm Lisa Phillip in Durham, North Carolina.
Louisiana has lost about 2,000 square miles of coastline in the last 80 years, according to estimates. That's an area the size of the state of Delaware. Coastal erosion and seawater damage have a lot to do with it, and now scientists are working to stop this. They've built a massive physical model of the Mississippi Delta to help them figure out the best way to restore the fragile Delta ecosystem. Joining us now is Clint Wilson, director of the Center for River Studies at Louisiana State University. And Clint, welcome to Here and Now.
Well, thank you, Mina. Appreciate being on.
Start by explaining the problem. Why are the Mississippi Delta wetlands being overtaken by saltwater?
Well, the biggest problem we have is that the river has been disconnected from a lot of the wetlands. And we made that decision as a nation, 150 years ago, and then reinforced that to allow the ships and allow the industries along the river to, grow. So we basically levied the river in order to, maintain the navigation and protect those communities. The result of that is that we've disconnected the river, and so the river is no longer delivering the water, the sediment, the nutrients back to the wetlands.
And that's caused seawater to inundate the area. What kind of damage has it caused?
Well, the biggest problem is that our coast is really a deltaic coast, so it relied upon the delivery of sediment over, thousands of years. And when you disconnect that, you get natural processes like subsidence, saltwater intrusion, and you get major wetland loss. The vegetation changes types and then at some point dies off. And so, we've lost, as you said, almost 2,000 square miles of wetlands, and that's projected to continue over the next 50 years.
So now you're hoping to divert parts of the river, bring sediment back to these wetlands?
That's correct. Yeah, the state's Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority, the lead agency, developed a master plan for restoration protection. One of the primary project types in their master plan is our sediment diversions. The idea is to, in a controlled way, reintroduce the river and its nutrients and its sediments back into our wetlands.
And this is a delicate process, I imagine, so that's why you need your model.
That's correct, because, at the same time we want to restore our coast, we've got to, ensure that the navigation industry is not disrupted. And then we also need to make sure that the communities, the people, the industries along the river, do not see any increased flood risk. So there is this balance, as you said, between the wetlands need these resources, and at the same time, the economy needs the river and the communities need to be safe.
Describe your model. It sounds massive, and also explain how you'll use it.
Certainly. Yeah, so the model covers, it's 90 by 120 feet in size, so a little, about the size of two basketball courts side by side. And it covers approximately 190 miles of the lower Mississippi River. And we're able to use the model to look at the flows in the river, the water levels along the river. We're able to look at relative sea level rise, so the combination of subsidence and the Gulf of Mexico rising, we're able to incorporate that into the model. And we're also able to, by using a very lightweight plastic material, we're able to replicate the Mississippi River sand. And so when you put all these things together, what we're really doing is looking in a kind of a macroscopic way at how the river's going to respond, whether it's sea level rise, different flows coming down the Mississippi River, or most importantly, we're going to be looking at the effectiveness of river sediment diversions and what impact they have on the river. In other words, are they going to increase or decrease dredging requirements in certain areas? Are we going to increase or decrease water levels in certain areas because we're of the sediment diversions? So those are the kind of things that we're going to study. And what makes the model, you know, so powerful really are two things. First is that we're able to replicate 1 year on the Mississippi River in 1 hour on the model. So we can basically go from January 1st through December 31st, go through low flow periods, high flow periods, when sand moves, when it doesn't move. The second thing that's really so powerful is the ability to let people see how the river responds. How does the sediment move?
You needed this $4 million model because it was important to make sure you wouldn't disrupt industry and residents who live nearby. But it also sounds like that you want to make sure you don't want to affect other parts of the river with these diversions.
Well, that's correct. You know, we want that balance between, you know, using the river and its resources for restoration, you know, not disrupting navigation and not increasing flood risk to any of the communities or industries. So, yes, we're able to look at, you know, if a river sediment diversion is located, you know, around 60 miles north of the Gulf of Mexico, you know, we're able to use this model to see what the impacts might be 10 or 15, 20 miles downstream from that diversion or 15, 20 miles upstream from that diversion.
What's your timeline? How soon could you begin diverting water to the Delta, diverting water and sediment?
The Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority is currently has an engineering team designing that structure, and they are also going through the permitting process with the Corps of Engineers. So I believe, you know, within 2 to 3 years, they hope to start turning dirt on this project.
Clint Wilson is the director of the Center for River Studies at Louisiana State University. Clint, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, there's another crisis on another iconic American river. Parts of the Rio Grande in New Mexico often run dry in summer, but mountain snowpack was so bad this year that at least 19 miles of the river has already evaporated, months ahead of schedule. Water managers say the state's largest reservoir will be nearly empty later this year, and they're having to evacuate tiny endangered fish. It's a symptom of a much larger problem. Demand for water is growing in the West, even as Western states are seeing warming temperatures and unyielding droughts. Carolyn Donnelly is supervisor of Northern Water Operations at the Bureau of Reclamation's Albuquerque office. Carolyn, describe for us what the river normally looks like in spring. I'm imagining, you know, swollen and rushing, and what it looks like now.
It's typical of Western rivers. It just depends on the year. So some years it's that rushing river where it's bank to bank, and that's what we had last year. And then unfortunately, some other years when the snowpack is low, it's shallow, or even in some reaches it does dry, and it's not uncommon to have dry parts of this river.
Well, but you don't sound too concerned. You know, are you? I mean, we're hearing that it might run completely dry in Albuquerque, and that might be rare. Put it in context.
It is rare. I don't believe that the Albuquerque Reach has dried since the 1980s. But I think one thing people don't realize is that's been because of management by government agencies for endangered species. So the Bureau of Reclamation, we've had to meet endangered species obligations, and we've leased a lot of water to support the silvery minnow. That's the tiny fish that's being rescued.
Well, but talk about this tiny fish. It can fit in the palm of your hand. We see these great pictures. We'll post them at herenow.org. We're also seeing pictures of crews going out into what used to be water and is now sort of a muddy or drying riverbed, and with nets scooping them up and moving them. Anytime a species is lost, it's not good for the ecosystem. And in this case, we know your agency is doing pulses of water to help it, what, spawn?
Yeah, we do that when we have an opportunity to do that. The life cycle of this fish is that they live maybe 2 to 5 years at the most. They spawn in the spring. They're cued naturally to spawn on that kind of a high pulse. And I think one thing that they've said, there used to be 5 native species of minnow in the Rio Grande, and the last one left is the silvery minnow, Rio Grande silvery minnow. So I think it's like the canary in a coal mine, that it's a sign of an ecosystem that maybe isn't in balance when you start losing species.
Well, we'll talk about the effect of that, because we're looking at, is it Elephant Butte Reservoir?
Yes, yes.
It's the state's largest. it's estimated that it'll be at just 5% capacity later this year. That's practically empty. We also read that a big percentage of the water from the river is used for agriculture. So, you know, what's going to be the impact when you don't have it?
So some irrigation districts, I think this is probably becoming more common across the West. If they're not getting enough surface water, then they may use groundwater. And I think that's one thing. Farmers are good at making these kind of economic decisions. And so if they're looking at a bad snowpack, they may decide not to plant.
A few years ago, there was a report from the Interior Department that looked at how climate change was affecting the Rio Grande Basin. It found the average temperatures rose a little less than 1 degree Fahrenheit per decade between 1971 and 2011. That's a huge rate, you know, when you compare it to the last 11,000 years. So are you also thinking about climate change?
Well, I think I've been busy enough. What I'm really thinking about is what's happening this year. But I think what we do see, though, is the runoff efficiency has been decreased. And so the plants with perhaps warmer temperatures, the plants higher up are taking up more of the water to grow. As snow melts off, the trees up in the forest are taking up water. And so it just means that for the same amount of snow or rain that falls up in a given area, what you see running off is less.
So you're saying these plants that are thriving because it's a warmer climate are needing more water, and so that water runoff isn't going to other places where it would have gone before?
I think that's what we're seeing, yeah.
Yeah.
And so all those plants are beautiful, and the trees are great, and I love walking in them myself, but they take a significant amount of water. Some people estimate that what we call the bosque or the forest next to the river takes up as much as 25% of the water.
And as temperatures change, that will only increase.
Yeah.
That's Carolyn Donnelly, Supervisor of Northern Water Operations at the Bureau of Reclamation's Albuquerque office. They're seeing a lack of snowpack there really affect the Rio Grande. Carolyn, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Boy, if you live in that area, I'd love to see some pictures of the river. Can you tweet them to @HereAndNowRobin? Love to see them.
Mike Pompeo has been officially sworn in as Secretary of State, taking the lectern after a glowing speech from President Trump. Pompeo described his priorities in the new role.
We will employ tough diplomacy when necessary to put the interests of the American people first. I will work to ensure their safety, to preserve their rights, and defend their values. And I will make sure America is always a respected and principled leader on the world stage.
A lot of challenges await Secretary Pompeo. His department's budget has been cut, and key positions remain unfilled. And the new chief diplomat will have to negotiate tensions with Iran, fears of a trade war with Europe, and potential talks with North Korea. Correspondent Michelle Kellerman covers the State Department for NPR. She joins us now. Pompeo's predecessor, Rex Tillerson, oversaw a drastic reduction in the State Department. He pushed out many senior officials and prompted resignations from diplomats. But for all of their other disagreements, Tillerson carried out Trump's government shrinking agenda, didn't he, Michelle?
Yeah, that's right. And it's not clear to me how much that really changes. I mean, it was the White House that set, you know, basically 30% budget cuts over here. Tillerson defended it. And we don't really know how much Pompeo is going to push back. But, you know, he's sending some positive signals, especially to the staff here, that he's going to start filling some of the vacancies that were left festering during the Tillerson's time. He's going to lift a hiring freeze on family members of employees posted overseas. So that's a start, and it's going to give him some room to maneuver here.
Well, speaking of starts, Pompeo had an unusual start to his tenure. He was barely confirmed by Congress before he began a whirlwind trip to the Middle East. What did Pompeo accomplish on that trip?
Well, yeah, he also went to NATO headquarters. That was his very first day on the job. And that's another thing that kind of distanced himself from the whole Tillerson era. Tillerson, the NATO foreign ministers had to change their schedule in order to get him to go to NATO. So here was Pompeo making a big show to the European allies and also to Israel, to Saudi Arabia and Jordan, key allies in the Middle East.
Today and yesterday, Pompeo promised to help the State Department and get its swagger back. What does he mean by that?
Well, he hasn't really said for sure, but, you know, it is kind of a demoralized place over here. This is trying to revive the department and to show that, you know, that it plays a role. You know, this was the first time that the president actually came to the State Department. He never did that during the during the Tillerson era. And I have to say that, you know, Obama came to the State Department on day three in office. So this was a long time coming, this visit here.
And quickly, Michelle, how have State Department employees received Pompeo? Are they optimistic? Are they responding to his message?
I think a lot are in a wait-and-see mode. They like what he's done and said so far, but they're also quite wary about his background. You know, he was a Kansas congressman who said a lot of controversial things about Muslims, about gays. He also touted military options over diplomacy. So there's a sense, you know, we got to wait and see. I mean, it's definitely the State Department officials who were up there in the room at the Ben Franklin room at this ceremonial swearing-in that we had here today were pleased to see that there's some new energy over in this building. And many told me that they were impressed by his first staff meeting here this morning.
That's NPR International Desk correspondent Michelle Kellerman.
So when was the last time you used a plastic straw, maybe with a takeout soda cup? How long did you use it? 10 minutes? How long will it last in the environment? Centuries. And maybe you're one of millions who've watched the excruciating YouTube video of a sea turtle having a plastic straw extracted from its nostril, bleeding, panting. Researchers think it's some kind of worm until they don't.
Yeah. Oh my God, she had a freaking piece of plastic. Okay, didn't we have this discussion the other day of how useless freaking straws are? So this is the reason why we do not need plastic straws.
How could that have possibly got lodged so firmly in a nostril?
We'll link you at hereandnow.org. It is hard to watch. In the U.S., an estimated 500 million single-use plastic straws are thrown away every day. In the U.K., the estimate is 8.5 billion thrown away every year. The U.K. is fighting back with a new law that would ban all sales of single-use plastics. That includes straws and Q-tips. But in the U.S. and Canada, the efforts are piecemeal and local. Malibu, California enacted a ban that goes into effect in public places in June. And the state of California is floating a proposal that would prevent restaurants from giving straws out unless customers ask for them. Let's bring in Nicholas Malice of Trash Free Seas. Nicholas, take up for some of the critics of banning straws. The disabled community, for instance, they say in many cases they need them to drink. Dentists who have to give them out after certain procedures. How do you handle that?
Like many policies out there, there's always some gray area. And I think there are certain applications when straws are absolutely appropriate. And several of those are ones you've just mentioned, whether it's for medical applications, whether it's for disabilities. There are some times when a straw is appropriate. And in those instances, it may be that, you know, you stick with a plastic straw for the time being. But even when a straw is needed, there are a lot of suitable alternatives that are out there. There are reusable rigid plastic straws that are out there. There are glass straws. There are metal straws. There are even paper straws. So yeah. I think the utility that it provides is something that, you know, we are not going to see go away. But I think it's just taking a moment to step back and think about what are other options out there that still deliver the same utility and properties that we want from that straw, but perhaps without the unintended end-of-life impacts that they do deliver to the environment.
Boy, the numbers are staggering. Canada had a shoreline cleanup. 17,000 straws were picked up. It's the ninth most common item found during cleanups supported by Oceanwise in Canada. And according to the World Watch Institute, the number of straws used daily in the United States could circle the planet more than 2.5 times every day. And we know you've been to regions where you've seen the impact of straws and plastics. What do you see?
I've been very fortunate to travel the world to look at the issue of plastics on beaches in the ocean. And two things that you notice is, one, unfortunately, it is everywhere. And two, there's a lot of it. There's a lot of plastic debris out there. You know, remote places like Alaska, you see large amounts of debris, massive fishing nets. In other places like Hawaii and the beaches of Southeast Asia, you see a lot of consumer products like bags, bottle caps, and specifically straws. So we know there's a lot of debris out there. We know there are a lot of straws out there, and volunteers through Ocean Conservancy's International Coastal Cleanup have collected some 3 million straws worldwide on just a single day's effort.
Oh boy.
And so while straws may be just one product, they may just be a small percentage of what's out there, you know, that's still 3 million fewer items that are in the ocean because of volunteers' efforts that could otherwise endanger wildlife.
Well, and speaking of wildlife, the sea turtle video is excruciating. I mean, this is a bloody, painful endeavor to get this now hardened plastic straw out of the animal's nostril. In what other ways do straws impact marine life?
Well, we know that some 8 million metric tons of plastic enters the ocean every year from land. And to put that into perspective, that's, you know, one New York City garbage truck full of plastic going into the ocean every minute of every day for an entire year. So it's a staggering amount. And, you know, more than 800 species of marine animals are now known to be impacted by plastics. And, you know, whether it's a straw or whether it's a bottle cap, those items can be eaten by animals and they pose threats through getting stuck in their digestive tracts. It can tear their stomachs. It can get stuck in their nose or their nostril like you saw with that turtle. So these products and plastics in their entirety are problematic. But what's equally, if not even more concerning, is that over time, when these materials are in the ocean, they begin to break up into smaller and smaller pieces. And as that single straw breaks into smaller and smaller pieces, a much broader range of the food chain can then ingest those pieces of plastic, ranging from the smallest things like zooplankton or clams or oysters, all the way up to sea turtles, all the way up to the great whales like the blue whale and humpback.
Mm. You know, there was an awareness campaign in the 70s and 80s now to cut up six-pack holders, the plastic six-pack holders, because we saw so many pelicans and other wildlife that would get them caught on their beaks and then they starved to death because they couldn't get this plastic off of them. So people were cutting it up. Might have been better for sea life in one way, but it's still plastic that's going into the oceans in some form, as you said, maybe to be ingested later. So on the one hand, it sounds like a public awareness campaign. People might cut back on their straws. But how to really, I mean, what's the solution here? It feels like it's already, you know, this horse is out of the barn.
There is no silver bullet. It is easy to feel overwhelmed by the issue. But I think when we look at this problem, it's a massive problem and we all have a role to play. And we as individuals, starting with things like straws, starting with things like taking your reusable bag or reusable coffee mug to the store, is an action that we all as a single individual can do. And when you take that single activity or that single action and roll that up collectively as a global society, it does yield very real impact for the ocean. But we also need to see leadership and proactive decisions by governments to put in place policies that are addressing the most problematic materials or products, are encouraging and incentivizing, you know, companies and industries to be making investments in the right innovation. And then lastly, we need industries to step up and ensure they are addressing some of the challenges that are currently exist with their packaging and the materials they use, and also look at things like fundamental access to waste collection and recycling in many places around the world where it currently does not yet exist.
Well, in the UK, there were three elements. There was a groundswell of demand from citizens. Then the UK passed a new law banning all sales of single-use plastics by next year. And McDonald's in the UK has started phasing out the straws. So you have people, government, corporations. Right there. Nick Malice, director of the Trash Free Seas program at the Ocean Conservancy, talking about moves to ban single-use plastics like straws. Nick, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin.
And this quick note, rapper Kanye West is in the headlines again. Last week, he proclaimed his love for President Trump. When the gossip news show TMZ asked him about that last night, as part of his answer, he said this.
You hear about slavery for 400 years? For 400 years? That sounds like a choice.
Kanye went on to add, it's all of y'all. It's like we're mentally in prison, but it did not go over well with black TMZ reporter Van Lathan.
You're entitled to your opinion. You're entitled to believe whatever you want. But there is fact and real world, real life consequence behind everything that you just said. And while you are making music and being an artist and living the life that you've earned by being a genius, the rest of us in society have to deal with these threats to our lives. We have to deal with the marginalization that has come from the 400 years of slavery that you said for our people was a choice. Frankly, I'm disappointed, I'm appalled, and brother, I am unbelievably hurt by the fact that you have morphed into something, to me, that's not real.
And here's some of the response on Twitter. Jackson said, Kanye West was right about one thing. Slavery was a choice for white people, an evil, abhorrent choice. And from Rowdy Biker, we're barely two generations removed from slavery and we're still treated as less than in this country. Hell, my parents were affected by Jim Crow laws, basically slavery rules disguised as laws, some of which are still on the books. Kanye West did not back down, though. He tweeted out, the reason why I brought up the 400 years point is because we can't be mentally imprisoned for another 400 years. We need free thought now. Even that statement was an example of free thought. And once again, I'm being attacked for presenting new ideas. He also claimed to quote Harriet Tubman, I freed 1,000 slaves. I could have freed 1,000 more if only they knew they were slaves. But it turns out that is a false quote. She never said it. And it is used by white supremacists to blame slaves for slavery.
E-bikes are growing in popularity. They're battery-powered and they help the bicyclist pedal. They're quickly competing for road space with regular people-powered bikes as more commuters embrace them. Baby boomers, too, are eyeing them. Colorado Public Radio's Grace Hood reports.
Suzanne Webel loves horses. She rides trails here around Longmont's expansive Langerman Agricultural Preserve. So when she heard that Boulder County could allow electric bikes on the same trails, she came to an event to check out how the e-bikes work and to give her opinion.
To see if the horse would be afraid of them more than a regular bicycle.
But as she straddles a red e-mountain bike, her thoughts veer towards newer conquests.
I'm not getting any younger. I thought, well, maybe I might enjoy going around on trails that I can't do anymore by having an e-bike.
Webel is one of hundreds of Coloradans learning more about e-bikes. The small motors don't make any sound. The only sound here is pedaling.
Okay, so I'm going to power up here.
They're popular in Asia and Europe, and slowly gaining traction in the United States. In Colorado, they came into the spotlight last year after the state legislature codified what they are and where they're allowed. The law gives local governments a say in which types of trails to allow them. Hard surface like bike paths or dirt mountain bike trails, or both.
We've had overwhelming response.
Erin Hartnett is a lead ranger for Boulder County Parks and Open Space. During a public comment period this winter, the county heard from more than 300 different people. Some called the idea dumbing down of exercise, cheating, and loud. Others emphasized seniors' rights over Boulder's mega athletes. The biggest contention is over Boulder's dirt trails.
We do have very popular, very busy trails, and it's multi-use, so we have potential for conflict, where we have bikers and hikers and runners and horseback riders all out there using the same trail system.
As more people move to the state, Colorado's trails have gotten more crowded, stoking tensions between bikers and hikers. And Marianne Bunnell with Jefferson County Open Space says local policies that consider e-bikes are unleashing emotional reactions.
We called the category general bike hate. And what it was people just, in the opportunity to say something, would say things like, I just don't like sharing the trail with bikes in general.
Bunnell managed Jeffco's public comment last year. That's when the county announced it would consider allowing e-bikes on dirt trails. But Bunnell did something unusual. At the same time she stopped hikers and logged their opinions about e-bikes, she recruited a few of the nearly silent e-bikes to ride by on the same trails.
Here's this person who's decided this thing is really a bad idea and yet can't recognize it when it's 2 feet from them. And so what was interesting to me was, if you can't detect it, is it really a problem?
This year, Jefferson County Open Space launched a pilot program. It will allow Class 1 e-bikes anywhere mountain bikes are allowed. Class 1 bikes engage the electrical motor when bikers pedal. Rangers and the rest of the team will closely monitor feedback.
Unfortunately, it's a very polarizing issue.
Gary Moore with the Colorado Mountain Biking Association says more research needs to be done.
There is so much that we don't know yet. There's still studies being done on the effects of these bikes on the trail systems and on other users and surrounding animals and wildlife.
Moore and his association are proceeding with caution. Their actions come after the International Mountain Biking Association softened its stance toward e-bikes in 2017 after years of opposition. The group now supports some e-bikes on trails if local governments are behind it. The change sparked a social media backlash. A few donors even canceled their memberships. Ultimately, Moore says his Colorado association doesn't want to lose any recent gains they've made.
Mountain biking is still the redheaded stepchild of off natural surface trails. We've worked long and hard for the better part of the last 30 years to gain access to areas that other trail users are already using, and we don't want to do anything to jeopardize that.
The fury over e-bikes isn't going away. More Colorado communities are expected to review their e-bikes policies in the coming year. Across the country, communities from Seattle, Washington to Washington, D.C. are also crafting e-bikes policies. When it comes to federal lands, the U.S. Forest Service doesn't allow e-bikes to go where mountain bikes go. For Here and Now, I'm Grace Hood.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Mina Kim.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now. Thank you.